The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Once more, unto the breach! Dear friends, once more, or close them all up with our English dead! In peace, there's nothing so becomes a man as modest stillness and humility. But when the blast of war blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the...
Why do you stop? Oh. You dance pretty. Go on, go on, go on.
Oh, Your Majesty, I didn't realize. After all, I'm not a dancing girl.
You show me. Teach, teach, teach.
Well, it's quite simple, Apolka. You count 1, 2, 3, and 1, 2, 3, and 1, 2, 3, and... Shall we dance? One,
two, now is the winter of our discontent, cloud of music, made glorious summer by this sun of York. And all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean, buried. Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths, our bruised arms hung up for monuments.
Every morning you greet me.
History as fiction. Historical fiction.
So now get up. Felled, dazed, silent he has fallen. Knocked full length on the cobbles of the yard, his head turned sideways. One blow, properly placed, could kill him now. So now get up!
Walters. My name's Hilary Mantel. My book is called Wolf Hall. It's about Thomas Cromwell, Tudor politician, chief fixer, a minister of everything.
I first published historical fiction in around 1993, my book on the French Revolution, and people had no hesitation in denouncing it without having read it, because it was fiction, therefore worthless.
So, is historical fiction still not quite respectable? Surely it is. Now that Hilary Mantel has won her Booker and Andrew Miller's Pure has been anointed Costa Book of the Year. For the last 2 years, the historical novel has even had its own prize, the Walter Scott Award, which with a purse of £25,000 for the winner, boasts to be the UK's second most lucrative literary prize after the Booker. Mantel and Andrea Levy were the first two winners, and the third year's judges have just been announced. We'll be hearing more shortly from Hilary about how she did have to break down many credibility barriers to get where she is today. But those battles are still being fought by many writers, among them Kate Grenville. Her novel, The Secret River, centred on a convict transported to Australia in the early 19th century. And even though it won her the Commonwealth Prize, it did cause her some conflict with historians. But dauntless, she is plunged once more and to the breach with a sequel, Sarah Thornhill. She told Sarah Crown what it was that drew her back to the same characters.
Well, it seemed to me that, you know, a secret has two parts. There's where you make the secret, and then there's one somewhere where someone discovers it, where someone uncovers the secret. And in The Secret River, I had set up the secret in a way. The reader knows what the secret is, of course. But The Secret River is about a man who is part of an Aboriginal massacre, which is then concealed and not recorded, a very common thing in Australian history. So there was the secret, but the next generation, of course, had no idea that he had done that. And I wondered what would happen when they found out. And I think the reason I wondered is that essentially it's the story that happened to myself. I grew up knowing very little about, you know, early Australian history in regards to the Aboriginal people. No idea that there were massacres all over Australia for 200 years. And so when I did, it was like uncovering a dirty secret, possibly in my own family, but certainly in my national history. And I thought, okay, I need to tell both sides of this secret.
And you talk about your family there. This is, to an extent, a family story of yours, isn't it? Sarah Thornhill's story. Do you want to explain a bit how you came upon it?
Yes, I was really lucky that I had a mother who had a strong sense of history. And she insisted on telling me the family stories, even when as a child, I remember with shame, I glazed over when Mum started in yet again on the story of our convict ancestor and his descendants. Now, of course, I bless her for that. And I bless myself, too, for being just smart enough to get it all down on tape before she died. So I had those stories, and it wasn't until I was about 50 that I actually went looking for them, that I was actually interested in them. But, of course, once you start delving into family history, particularly in Australia, where there are so many secrets, both in people's families and in the country as a whole, it's like pulling a loose thread in a jumper. You know, before you know where you are, you've got a big heap of thread on the floor and no jumper. It's, for a novelist, exactly what you need. I had just enough information to get going, but it was all questions. And for a novelist, that's like a red rag to a bull.
And so what were those first clues that you happened upon?
There was a recurring sort of myth in the family story that my great-great-great-grandfather, the convict, had a daughter who'd got pregnant to the riding master and was thrown out of the house and died. And when I went looking in the archives, finally, I found that this couldn't be so. But there was another person who might possibly have got pregnant to the riding master and died, and that was his granddaughter, who was the daughter of his son and a Maori woman. So she was a half-Maori child. And when her parents died, she was sent for by my great-great-great-grandfather. So there's this little Maori girl who's about six, who's taken away from her family, her language, everything she's ever known, and sent to live on the Hawkesbury in Australia. And teasing out little mysteries in the family story, I realised that she died at a very young age, about 13, under very mysterious circumstances. So putting two and two together, as always with family history, it's a lot of guesswork and it's a lot of speculation. But I suddenly felt this vivid sense of the misery that that little girl had lived through, and that if she had found some consolation with the riding master or some other person on the property, thank goodness she found that, at least.
A lot of the narrative drive of the novel comes from Sarah's sense of family responsibility. And obviously this is the story of your family, and I wondered whether that feeling of family responsibility was one that you still experience now, you know, many generations down the line, and whether there was a sort of exculpatory sense to the novel at all for you.
In a way, this novel and its prequel, The Secret River, are my way of saying I'm sorry for some of the sins that were committed either by my ancestors or by others in Australia. I felt that our family had hidden a lot of these stories. I mean, there were two big secrets. One was the secret of the little girl brought from New Zealand. Mm. And the other, of course, was the possibility of a massacre of Aboriginal people, or at least a violent sending of them away from the land that my forebear took. So on both of those counts, I felt not exactly guilty, not exactly responsible. It's odd, there really isn't quite a word for it. What I felt, though, was a compelling need to acknowledge and make public those secrets so that at least I wouldn't be responsible for continuing to brush them under the carpet.
But I was actually quite surprised by the level of integration that you describe. And so, for example, Jack, he is half Aborigine, half white. By and large, it is kind of accepted. There is a social acceptance of the fact that this happened, that there were interracial marriages and that kind of thing.
It certainly was a very pragmatic thing in the beginning. Men outnumbered women for the first, 30 years or something of the colony. So Aboriginal women, who were usually taken by force, filled that gap. The question of those children who resulted, it seemed to me that until about the 1820s, there wasn't any particular racism towards those children, but after that there was. Some kind of guillotine came down. The racial boundaries were not policed nearly as strictly in the early days as they were later on, when there was a greater anxiety, I think.
Do you think that was a social anxiety? Because that seems to be what's creeping in the novel, is this sense of a social hierarchy, which then, you know, extends to race as well, I suppose.
I think so. That's certainly my reading of it, that people like my forebear, who were, you know, illiterate, labouring class, respected a man, basically, or a woman, for the person they were. And so I say in the book, you know, if Jack Langland could use an axe and an oar, then he was as good as the next man. But from the 1820s or 1830s, there were, instead of it being mainly a community of ex-convicts, there became many more free settlers. And they, I think, brought with them ideas about gentility and ideas about what was appropriate and their need to draw the lines, but the boundaries between, you know, us and them were very strong.
You said earlier on that this novel taps into a sort of national guilt that's felt in Australia about the events that happened when the country was settled by white settlers. What has the reaction been like in Australia to this book and to The Secret River?
When The Secret River came out, I was deluged with letters from readers thanking me for making it possible for them, I think, to access some of these ideas, people who would not normally read, you know, heavy-duty history. It seemed to me there was a huge hunger out there for people to know. We all kind of knew that things had happened, but people of my generation were brought up with this illusion that, you know, all the Aboriginal people. The reason there were no Aboriginal people left in many parts of Australia is that they'd all got measles and had no, you know, resistance to it. We all kind of knew that this was wrong. And so The Secret River gave people a way of starting to think about it, I think. And because it's fiction, it wasn't too confronting. With fiction, you can always reassure yourself that, after all, this is just made up. And with this book, it's the same thing. People are writing to me and saying, thank you for telling these stories that have been hidden. And, of course, I get a lot of letters from women specifically saying, thank you for trying to put the women's stories on the map. A couple of historians with The Secret River were cranky that I was writing something that they felt was their territory. You know, this is hard stuff to think about. Here we are as white Australians living incredibly privileged lives, and we're doing it really on the back of 200 years of oppression and misery and murder, basically. To actually look that fact in the face is extremely confronting, very difficult. So I think when those historians really diverted the debate away from what I'd been writing the books about, which is the massacre and what the beneficiaries of that do with that knowledge, I think they felt that this was a chance to kind of divert the debate into something more comfortable, which is the debate of, you know, is it history, is it fiction, how far should novelists go in writing historical fiction? For 200 years, we've kept so quiet about all this. I mean, even having a convict forebear used to be absolutely shameful. When I was growing up, people would go to all sorts of lengths to disguise that, including, it is said, going into the archives and actually ripping the page out of the ledger where the convict names were listed. So, you know, there are plenty more secrets still to uncover.
I heard the convict, his faith bewailing, as on the sunny riverbank he lay. I am a native of Erin's Island, though banished now from my native shore. They tore me from my aged parents and from the maiden whom I do adore. I've been a prisoner at Port Macquarie, at Norfolk Island, and at Port
So Kate Grenville knows that you have to be good at your fiction and get your facts straight to get away with writing it at all. And that's pretty much Hilary Mantel's experience too, as she explained in a conference between historians and writers called Novel Approaches, convened by the Institute of Historical Research recently.
Welcome to the Institute of Historical Research's winter conference, Novel Approaches. So we've got two speakers who really don't need much of an introduction. Hilary Mantel, the Man Booker Prize-winning author of Wolf Hall. And on my right is Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Wales, David Lodes, honorary member of the History Faculty at the University of Oxford.
One of the revelations to me after I published Wolf Hall was that, by and large, although historians might not agree with my interpretation of events, on the whole, they weren't hostile to the whole enterprise. I expected to be some sort of intellectual leper because I first published historical fiction in around 1993, my book on the French Revolution, and people had no hesitation in denouncing it without having read it, because it was fiction, therefore worthless. Thankfully, the climate has changed. I'll tell you, first of all, how I came to historical fiction. It was out of exasperation. I wanted to read a book that didn't exist. When I was a child, I used to read my mother's Jean Pleiades and all the rest of it, and those anachronistic ladies on the cover with the pointy headdresses with veils at the back and their bosoms hoisted up and their lipstick on. And this was historical fiction. I thought I should have read history at university, and I didn't. How could I work my way in? Well, I'd have to settle for second best and I'd have to become a historical novelist. And so I began work with this kind of cultural cringe. I was completely prepared to read all the historians, read all the source material I could get at. What I wasn't prepared for were the silences of history, the erasures and the gaps. You see, I will make up the thoughts of a man's heart, but I will not make up the colour of his drawing room wallpaper. I'm not so much terrified of large mistakes, because I know that historians make them all the time, careering off after daft theories. Therefore, I don't make large claims for historical fiction. I'm standing on the shoulders of historians, and I'm indebted to them.
So let's get a broader view of that debate from its convener, Jane Winters, who joins me here in the studio. Jane, standing on the shoulders of historians. You are one of them. You're a medieval historian, no less.
It's a very nice thing for her to have said. And I think one of the things that came out of our conference is that actually that works both ways, that historians can also draw on historical fiction. And in some ways that can set the agenda too. The example that one of our speakers quoted was Pat Barker's Ghost Road, which predated any serious academic treatment of shell shock. So what the relationship between the two is isn't quite clear, but it's not all in one direction.
You refer to this on your website as a virtual conference. What does that mean?
Yes. We ran a physical event over an evening and a day and had the speakers in and ran it like a normal academic conference. But we had so much interest in the subject and from a group of people that wouldn't normally come to academic conferences that we wanted to make it available more widely. So we posted the following week all of the podcasts and discussion according to a conference schedule so that people could feel that they were part of a real debate and dialogue and come to it in the same way that the physical delegates had.
You run the Institute of Historical Research. What is that?
It's one of 10 postgraduate institutes in the School of Advanced Study in the University of London. We deal with the humanities and social sciences. So it's a real hub for humanities and social science research in Bloomsbury.
Now, in terms of the people who you invited, I mean, presumably these are largely novelists, not your normal sort of interlocutors.
We tended to go for people who had a foot in both camps.
Such as?
People like Alison Weir and Ian Mortimer and Rebecca Stott and Stella Tillyard, who start out as academics, not always historians in some of those cases, and then move into writing fiction, because that's a trend that seems to have been happening more and more. And Kate Williams is one of the most recent examples of that.
Is there still a hostility between writers and academics?
Much less so these days, I think. I can still remember being caught, as I saw it, by my PhD supervisor reading a historical novel while I was waiting for him to arrive and being very very embarrassed about it because it, you know, in some way it wasn't respectable. And I think we've lost that now. And that was one of the reasons for organising the conference. And that was really crystallised by Wolf Hall, because something had changed between the publication of a book like A Place of Greater Safety.
Which was her novel of the French Revolution.
Which is a great book. And it was very well reviewed, but it didn't make anything like the splash or have the impact of Wolf Hall, which is now, you know, that's proper literary fiction. It's not just genre writing. So something's changed in the way it's perceived, and there's certainly nothing like the hostility that there might have been once. In fact, a lot of the historians that we spoke to admitted to having partly gone on to study because of books that they read when they were teenagers in particular. And I think they're freed up to say this now in a way that they might not have been a few years ago.
Now, in the run-up to this podcast, we've been canvassing opinion from our Twitter followers and from our readers on theguardian.co.uk/books. In fact, it was through Twitter that you made contact with me, Jane. But here is a medley of our readers' favourites, both on the website and on Twitter. And if you notice a couple of entries from Ken Follett, be advised he did put in a crafty little tweet reminding us all of his existence.
It's an outrage, too. We're blessed with many good historical novelists, but Patrick O'Brien is by far the best I've read. His horizons are vast. Adventure, natural science, music, politics, philosophy, Georgian domestic life, religion, geography, discovery, and yet more adventure. And at the same time, he can evoke the claustrophobia and little dramas of a two-year voyage on a small ship. His characters live until occasionally, almost incidentally, they die. He was Mary Renault's favourite novelist, and she was my favourite until I read O'Brien.
Leo Toadstool. J.G. Farrell's Troubles. Well, the whole Empire trilogy, but specifically Troubles. Beautiful, multifaceted historical fiction without the pulp clichés.
Kushti, Chinua Achebe, Things Fall Apart, a useful reminder that there are other histories than those of the West.
Alojzy Volodin, Vasily Grossman's life and fate is a cinematic, even journalistic recasting of Tolstoy's War and Peace in the context of the Great Patriotic War, though I don't think you could ever call it an imitation. I think that it is in something of a dialogue with Tolstoy's labour.
Historical novelists, Patrick White's Voss is the original and still unsurpassed neo-Victorian novel. The subgenre is now well-established and critically examined.
Lore. Pillars of the Earth by Ken Follett and The Other Boleyn Girl by Philippa Gregory are my all-time favourites. At Historical Novels.
Laura Callahan. The Cairo Trilogy, Naguib Mahfouz. Wonderfully rich and moving account of a defining period of change.
The James Hughes. American Tabloid by James Elroy. Perfectly encapsulates a defining period of American history.
Girl Who Loves Books, adore Fingersmith, but my first hashtag historical novels love was The Eagle of the Ninth, which my mum read to me as a child.
Jane, that was a sweet little exchange there, wasn't it?
Very much so.
On the actual discussion thread, there was a really interesting exchange between historical novelist and somebody who I hope I'm not mispronouncing as Pro Ev Pete. Historical novelist made a very strong case for Patrick White's Voss as the original and still unsurpassed neo-Victorian novel. And says the subgenre is now well established and critically examined, but the revival of Victorian forms really started with this novel and was picked up again with a postmodern twist by Fowles in The French Lieutenant's Woman. Pro Ev Pete, and goes on to say, moving on from Lukács, if anybody's interested, people should check out Patricia Waugh's Metafiction or take the next step into Linda Hutchins' historiographic Metafiction in A Poetics of Postmodernism. That's from 1988. I find this fascinating. So we've got people who are coming into a thread about historical fiction talking absolutely from a academic background.
Absolutely. And that was something that ran through all of the discussion in our conference, that it is starting to have theory behind it. And a lot of major academic conferences, the Association of American Historians, for example, they have a conference in January every year. And one of the most well-attended sessions there was looking at the relationship between historical novels and academic history. And it's moving out, I think, of literary studies as well, where you might expect it to have a home and historians are engaging with it in new ways. One of our speakers, Beverly Southgate, has written an excellent book, History Meets Fiction, which is looking at exactly these things and addressing the boundaries between the two and how the demarcation is no longer so clear-cut.
What's the address of your website?
The address is IHRconference, all one word, .wordpress.com. So it's set up in a blog format so people can still contribute even though the conference itself is at an end.
Jane, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Beautiful Lies. It's 1887 and London is in turmoil. Grand celebrations are planned for Queen Victoria's Golden Jubilee, but poverty, unemployment and Irish terrorism mean strikes, riots and bomb plots.
Back now to the writers. And to draw this discussion together, I asked a distinguished writer of historical fiction, Claire Clark, to come in and explain it all to us. She's twice been longlisted for the Orange Prize, by the way. Her latest novel, Beautiful Lies, set in the 19th century, is coming out this summer.
The whole term historical novel has rather changed, certainly in the last 20 years. And if one looks at, I think it was the Booker Prize list when Hilary Mantel won with Wolf Hall, every single one of the novels on the shortlist had a historical subject. But very few of those novelists would have described themselves as writing historical fiction. So I think that we actually are in a time where stories with historical settings are flourishing enormously. But I think that we're also in a time when novelists shy away from the term historical fiction.
Let's just start with talking about your own novels. How do you choose your periods?
Well, a lot of it is really what catches my eye at the time. Hilary Mantel, I read a thing with Hilary Mantel the other day that said that novels squat inside you and then they come up and ambush you when you're least ready. And I think that that's a very good description, actually. And I started off in the Victorian period mostly, actually, because I had had a disappointment with a previous contemporary novel that was never published. And when I said to my agent in rage that I was going to write a historical novel because I thought it would be a good change for me, I said to her, what period is extremely commercial because I'm not going to have another disaster on my hands. And she said, Victorian does very well. And if you could put a murder in, that'd be even better.
And that was the great stink.
And that was the great stink. And it helped enormously, actually, that I was living. I'd just moved back to London, which is why I knew I wanted to write a historical novel, because I'd lived in America for 4 years. And I came back to London where I'd lived all my life. And I suddenly realised that I'd sleptwalked my way through London, whereas I'd lived in a foreign city for 4 years and really interrogated it. And I moved into an area of South London which had really only become habitable, if you like, with the arrival of the trains in 1830. So I was quite interested in this idea that a swamp had been reclaimed. This is Wandsworth, where we live. But every time I read about the trains in the reference books that I found, they kept talking about the sewers at the same time because they were all being constructed at the same time. The whole of London was, I mean, we think that London's always being dug up now. It had nothing on 1850s London. I didn't mean to write a book that took place in the new London sewers, but it was an irresistible pull when it came along.
And the building of London has featured quite a lot in your novels, hasn't it? Because then you talked about St. Paul's in The Nature of Monsters.
I did. I think I'm fascinated by how London is like a sort of rock formation. You know, it's built up on layers upon layers, and we can see very clearly snippets of all of its different incarnations. I think that it's interesting you were talking about the new books that were coming out this year. They're very Victorian. And I think that Victorian London is very much the London that we live in still.
So The Nature of Monsters went back to the 18th century.
The Nature of Monsters went right back to the beginning of the 18th century. Because I was very interested in a London that was almost half medieval still, but just becoming a modern city. And the period I was writing about in The Nature of Monsters was the period of the very first stock market crash. The South Sea bubble exploded in 1720, just after St. Paul's had been constructed. And I was very interested in St. Paul's too, because it was obviously a great religious symbol and built to rival St. Peter's in Rome very specifically. But it was also a temple to London's wealth. It was a very clear outward sign of how rich we were. And right from the beginning, they were charging entry.
Beautiful lies. It just sounds like it could absolutely be an echo of what we're going through now. Riots, Golden Jubilee, all that sort of thing.
And it really is. And the modern world was just starting to emerge, because it wasn't just that it was a time of economic crisis. It was also the time of the first emergence of press influence. So for the very first time, newspapers were also getting in on the act, and newspapers had dislodged, by 1887, when the book is set, newspapers had dislodged one MP and were well on the way to dislodging Parnell, who was the great Irish reformer. There were camps in Trafalgar Square, not so very far away from Occupy London. There were riots with people smashing windows. There was a great deal of upset about the divide between rich and poor, and the fact that some people had everything and other people had nothing. I think one of the joys of writing historical fiction is exploring what it would have been like to live in times that have parallels with one's own, therefore one connects with them, but which have structures and formalities and social conventions that are entirely different.
Now, you're a historian by training. Well, your degree was in history.
Yes.
But you didn't take it further than that.
No, I didn't. I did a runner from university as soon as I was able, and came to London and worked in advertising, rather bizarrely, for 11 years. So what I would say is that what I learned at university was how not to be afraid of the research. Putting this great big pile of books on your desk, they open up worlds that, you know, set you on fire and make you feel unbelievably excited to tell stories to other people.
Can we just go now, broaden out a little bit and look at all the various movements in historical fiction? Because like every other sort of literature, it has lots of different sectors, doesn't it? I mean, there is the Philippa Gregory, Alison Weir, Tudor Plantagenet, what I think of as costume drama, is that fair? Done very accurately by historians. But in a way, I have always had a feeling historians slumming it, is that fair?
There used to be what people have called sort of chick lit with wimples, you know, putting very modern characters into historical settings, which I think any historian would balk at very profoundly. You know, so you've got someone who's Tudor, but who has profoundly 20th or 21st century instincts. And I think that most serious writers of historical fiction would find that slumming it. But I think that actually, if you don't convince, you probably don't sell at all now. And people expect to learn something, I think. I think that a lot of the time when I talk to people about historical fiction and why they read historical fiction, it's because it's a way of understanding a period without having to flog through academic book.
So now what about, you touched on it a bit earlier, the nostalgia, the Gosford Park?
I mean, I think there is something eternally fascinating about the upstairs-downstairs dynamic now that we've lost it so completely. Telly, Downton Abbey, I know that the more serious historians among my acquaintance all deny they watch it in public, but I think that's a naughty little secret.
They secret it. I think in their bedrooms.
Yes, absolutely. And part of the joy is pointing out, rather snootily, what would never have happened in real life. And I think that there's always been an escapist element in historical fiction.
And that's true of the written fiction as well as televised fiction, is it?
Most literary fiction that takes a historical subject is attempting to get to some truth about the human condition. I think it uses historical settings and historical constraints to explore what human beings are capable of. I think there's a probably less demanding strata of fiction that allows you just to have a jolly good romp in a sort of fictionalised version of the past, where the difficulties of living in the past, and God knows being a historian makes you realise you'd rather live now than any other time, but where the difficulties and discomforts of living in the past are glossed over and the costumes and jewellery are given centre stage.
Now, I'm going to play devil's advocate. Why do we not invent new stories? And this was a criticism that came up a lot in the year that Wolf Hall, Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, won the Booker.
I think it's not true. I think we do invent all the time. I think that stories set against a historical background are no less invented than ones imagined now. I mean, I think the interesting thing about history is that for most of us, our history is not a very reasoned understanding of the past. It's a sort of mishmash of factoids and received wisdoms and accepted fictions about what happened. And therefore, I think a lot of historical fiction plays a role in opening up stories, new stories, obviously imagined stories, against a context of a background that people are actually quite unfamiliar with, and also explaining a past that we all have an ancestry from, if you like. I mean, I think the truth about contemporary fiction is that nobody is writing a truer version of today, because they're writing from where they sit. They're writing the view of the world from the angle that they can see it. And a historian has a slightly more, sits higher up the building, if you like. You know, you're more like looking from the 42nd floor than you are from looking from the first floor. And that doesn't make the stories any more or less valid. It just makes them different.
It just struck me when listening to you talking that there's a similarity there with science fiction, other worlds evoking this world, but from a different planet.
I think there is. I did a very interesting event once at a festival with a science fiction writer where the event organiser had put us together. Really what we're all doing, and actually writers of contemporary fiction are doing this too, are creating a world into which a reader can step fully formed. You know, it is a convincing world that doesn't leak. And the only times that fiction doesn't work is when you cease to believe in the world in which you're operating. You either the characters have failed to convince or the setting fails to convince. The successful historian or historical fiction writer and the successful sci-fi writer has done the same thing, which is to imagine a world that is entirely credible and whole.
Now, you get asked, because you're a historical novel, to review historical novels. You review very well for The Guardian, in fact. Tell us the novels that you've spotted that you've really liked.
I was thinking about that. I mean, one that obviously comes to mind, because it's, thank goodness, been recognised recently, is Andrew Miller's Pure, which I did review for The Guardian, which I absolutely loved, which abandons really any particular convention of historical fiction and in a very poetic way explores the years preceding the French Revolution and is a fable, really, a parable. And books like J.G. Farrell's The Siege of Krishnapur, Rose Tremaine's Restoration, The Remains of the Day, Ishiguro. But I was looking, I'd forgotten that The Blind Assassin, Margaret Atwood's The Blind Assassin, and The True History of the Kelly Gang won the Booker in two consecutive years. So I think the great novels have always been recognised. And there are some wonderful, wonderful, wonderful ones out there. And luckily, people are still producing them.
Claire Clark there. And that's all we have for you this week. I hope you enjoyed the wealth of material we also gave you on our site for Valentine's Day, including Lady Antonia Fraser reading one of her husband Harold Pinter's love poems, Blake Morrison reading from Tom Gunn, and Carol Ann Duffy reading from Carol Ann Duffy. You can find them all on guardian.co.uk if you missed them. We had an excellent discussion too about Lawrence Durrell on the site following last week's podcast. Do write your comments about this one on the page below the audio player. If you've come to us through iTunes, that's at guardian.co.uk/books. And do subscribe to become a regular listener. Sarah Crown now joins me to run through everything that's coming up in the week elsewhere.
Yes, we've got in the Guardian Saturday Review, Colm Toybin writing about writers and their parents with particular reference to his own. And there's more family saga in the Weekend magazine, which has an extract from Rachel Cusk's book about her divorce, Aftermath. And then if you come onto the site on Monday, there's going to be a Q&A with Rachel Cusk as well.
And on Saturday at the Guardian offices just behind London's King's Cross Station, we're opening an exhibition of our winner and all the shortlisted illustrations for our Lord of the Flies cover design competition. There were 277 entries in all, and we've shortlisted 21, and I can tell you they are absolutely gorgeous, so do hurry along. We will also have a gallery up on the site. But that's all for now. Thanks to Sarah and to Kate Grenville, Claire Clark, Jane Winters, and our producer, Tim Mabey. I'm Claire Armistead. Goodbye.
I'm one of the has-beens, a shearer I mean. I once was the ringer, and I used to shear clean. I could make the wool roll off like the soil from the plough. But you may not believe me, 'cause I can't do it now. I'm as awkward as a new chum, And I'm used to the frown that the bossy often shows you, saying, keep them blades down.
The Hawkesbury was a lovely river, wide and calm, the water dimply green, the cliffs golden in the sun, and white birds roosting in the trees like so much washing. It was a sweet thing of a still morning, the river oaks whispering and the land standing upside down in the water. They called us the colony of New South Wales. I never liked that. We wasn't new anything. We was ourselves. The Hawkesbury was where the ones come that was sent out. Soon as they got their freedom, this was where they headed. 50 miles out of Sydney, not a magistrate or a police to be seen. A man could pick out a bit of ground, get a hut up, never look back. You heard that a lot. Never looked back. Pa started a boatman on the Thames. Then he was sent out. What for, I never knew. I was a pestering sort of child, but he'd never say. Just went on sitting in the armchair, smiling away at nothing and smoothing the nap of the velvet. I never saw Pa lift an axe or carry a stick of firewood, and he had other men now to do the rowing for him. Done enough work for any man's lifetime, he'd say. He'd set the men to chipping between the corn rows, mucking out the hog pens, fill his pipe and stand watching them work, point and call out if he thought they wasn't doing it right. He made them call him Sir, a flogging if they forgot. When you'd done as well as Pa had, no one said sent out. Now he was what they called an old colonist. Still plenty of folk who wouldn't put their feet under the same table as an emancipist or invite him into their house. As far as some people went, sent out meant tainted for all time. You and your children and your children's children. But for other folk, money had a way of blunting the hard shapes of the past, dressing it up in different words. Pa was Mr. Thornhill of Thornhill's Point now, but he had some habits that were from before. Of an afternoon, he'd get a bit of bread and go out on the veranda. Sit on a hard bench beside the window with the bread and a glass of rum and water beside him on the sill. He'd put his telescope up to his eye and look through it for an hour at a stretch. Straight across the river, up at the line of bush along the top of the cliffs. Nothing up there, only rocks and trees and sky. But he'd sit watching for something, the leather worn through to the brass, where his hand clamped round it. None of us Thornhills had our letters, but you didn't need a book to work out how to count, at least what you had the fingers for. One day, I'd have been 5 or 6, I went out to Pa on the veranda. A shiny morning, the river with a brush of wind on it that sent a handful of sparkles across the water. I've got 3 brothers, I said. Ain't I, Pa? His face always seemed bigger than other people's. Big chin, big nose, big cheeks, and his eyes, the way one was a different shape from the other, that you only saw when he looked at you straight on. Which he did that time. Those blue eyes and his mouth a funny shape. No, Dolly, he said, you got 4 brothers. Took a gulp of his rum and water, so I could hear it go down his gullet as if it was having to find its way round something in there. You got 4 brothers, Dolly, he said, only Dick's gone away for a time. How come, I said, how come he went away? Where'd he go? His face hardened down. I knew that meant trouble. Told myself, let it go. When's he coming back, Pa? I said, when's Dick coming back? Then he was on his feet, the glass knocked over, the bench clattering on the board so the dust flew up, and he was above me, his big face shouting down into mine, a dizzy ringing when his hand caught me across the side of the head, my ear making a high, thin noise, like something screaming a long way off. Pushed me hard, so I stumbled through the doorway into the hall. I crept upstairs to the bedroom, got in the bed, coiled myself up small as I could go, pulled the blanket over my head. In the stuffy dark, I folded my fingers over one by one. Johnny, Bub, Will. 1, 2, 3. That was how it was on the Hawkesbury. Everything hidden away, and those everlasting cliffs and ridges blocking us into the narrow valley. I wanted to push them back, get a clear look at all the things that people knew but wouldn't say.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.